Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out, progressive voices from around the valley and around the nation, conversing about issues important to our community. Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out. Today we talk about the 2010 census. April 1st, 2010 is Census Day. Recently, each household should have received their census form via mail. Each census form asks 10 questions. Today we talked with Denny Luna, a media specialist for the U.S. Census. Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out, Denny.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Much has been done in traditionally undercounted communities to raise awareness about the census. Which communities are we talking about?
We know that ever since the census began, way back in 1790, there's always been an undercount. And the reason that we know that is Thomas Jefferson actually delivered the results in two colors of ink. One was in black ink, and that was how many was actually on the count. And then the other figure was in red ink, and that was the number that people thought it really was. And back then you had each state, like Thomas Jefferson said, well, I know we've got more people in Virginia, and someone else said, no, we've got more people here. So we've always had this sort of struggle with how to reach everybody. It is a huge mandate. It is actually in our Constitution to count everyone. But we always end up with fewer people than actually there are. And we think that the undercount is actually about 1.5%. We do even have an overcount, and that would be affluent whites, people with two homes for the most part. But we also have this undercount, and they traditionally tend to be people that are not as plugged into the mainstream society. Back in 1990 census was probably the worst undercount, and the one group that was undercounted in particular was Native Americans. They were undercounted by about 12%, and we had the African Americans undercounted at about 5%, and Hispanics about 5% also. So for various reasons, sometimes it's a language barrier. Sometimes it is people who are living off the grid and really don't want to have much to do with government folks. A whole host of reasons. And it's our job to go out there and be on programs like this and try to get everyone to know that the census is very easy to participate in. Very short time needed to fill out that census form, and I'm sure we'll get into that later. It's very safe, and it's absolutely important. It brings in a lot of dollars and a lot of influence for them.
How are the efforts going to communicate with the undercounted communities?
We have this time around an expanded partnership program, and by partnership, I mean we have already signed on 200,000 organizations nationwide to volunteer and go out and spread our message. That is more people than we had in all of 2000. Back then we had 140,000. We thought we were doing pretty darn good at that, but we've already surpassed that. The reason that we have a partnership program is that people aren't necessarily going to automatically do what the government says. They're more apt to listen to the people that they know best, the people that they've worked with and in their community over the years and that they trust. So we have organizations, be they churches or a nonprofit organization or businesses, everything from, I don't know if I want to give some free commercials here, but Best Buy and Target and Costco down to the local beauty and barbershops. They have signed on to become census partners. And that is a voluntary thing. They don't do anything else but really go out and help us spread the message. In addition to that partnership program, we have a lot of materials in different languages. We also have staff that speak a number of different languages. We have advertising out now, and it'll be out in about 29 different languages in certain areas. We have the materials in 59 languages. We have staff that actually speak about 100 languages. We have some telephone assistance centers. So we're really trying to get out the word to everyone. And now that we've got a very diverse country, it's a challenge sometimes.
That's quite a collection of organizations and people that are working toward this. Does that include the Complete Count Committee?
Yes. The Complete Count Committees are absolutely central to what we're doing. By Complete Count Committee, and sometimes we call them CCCs, those are down to the very local level, and they're generally appointed at a state level, starting with a state CCC. Then there are cities that, say, will have their entire city become a CCC with their community partners, and then it'll subdivide so that maybe their Department of Transportation will have their own CCC, and it just kind of branches out. Usually they are appointed by a public official, but they don't need to be. And to be honest, they don't even need to call themselves a CCC. It's all pretty much what they feel works best in their particular community and a particular group of folks to get the word out.
The forms have been delivered. When should they be returned?
We want people to return the forms as soon as possible. We have named April 1st as Census Day, but people should not wait until April 1st to send them in. They should just get them in the mail as soon as possible. That saves them time, and it saves us a lot of time and expense. We are spending that cost of a postage stamp to get people to mail it in, and that's relatively inexpensive. But if they don't send it in, we are required to go out and pursue the non-response households. We will follow up with a telephone call, and if that doesn't work, then we will actually go out to the house. And we will go out more than one time until we get that information recorded. So on the average, it costs us about $57 per household for every home that doesn't return the form versus that cost of a postage stamp. So we hear a lot about government spending, and we know these are tight economic times. So this is a way to really save the government some money. It adds up, believe it or not, to about $1.5 billion if we were to get everybody to turn in their form versus having to send someone to the house.
Considerably more cost effective for us.
Right. I mean, it's cost of a postage stamp versus that $57 per house.
In 2000, my understanding is the participation rate was about 75%. What's projected?
We hope that we will match that, but honestly, we don't really know for sure. We had 3 decades of declining returns, and then we reversed that in 2000, and our projections at that time were that we were going to have an even worse time of it than the time before, so 4 decades of diminishing returns. One of the reasons why we think we reversed that trend and we actually got more people despite their busy lives, et cetera, was the expanded partnership program and a little bit of advertising. We did a little advertising back then. We increased it about a third this time around. We had a congressional budget office review that, and they determined that the advertising was a very good investment. So they sanctioned more of that this time around. All of this is really something that we feel is going to save taxpayer dollars. And sometimes you need to spend a little to save a little. And what we do spend, it's a gauge so that in the end we can get everyone counted in the easiest and least expensive manner.
So Denny Luna of the U.S. Census, can you explain to us why this information is needed and what it's used for?
The information is needed. It's required by law. So every question on there has been passed through some review committees, and that process begins almost a decade before. It goes through a congressional review process after that. And all this is really years before the actual census. The questions need to have some kind of tie-in legally so that there are program mandates that say you have to disperse your funding according to the census counts. That is a primary reason why we ask the people answer all the questions. The earliest census...
Could you give us some examples of that?
Yes. It does stem all back to 1790 and the original Constitution and the Census Act of 1790 itself, where they felt that they were going to have a different kind of country. So the census in other countries at that time was used to conscript people into the military or to find out who was where so that they could get a bigger tax base. The census wasn't really a popular thing. But what the American founders wanted was to uniquely use the census to record where people were and use that data to disperse the federal funds and to allot the political power. So they said that the Electoral College and the House of Representatives of 435 people in the House of Representatives would be divided according to the census count. And furthermore, they said that federal revenue would be divided according to that census count. They actually asked pretty similar questions in that form of 1790 than we're asking today. And they were asking back in that time how many people in the household, which we also, of course, ask, and what type of folks, if they were white males over the age of 16, if they were slaves, if they were women, if sort of the very similar kinds of things, so an age and gender and count breakdown. It's pretty much what we ask today.
What are the top 10 federal programs that utilize that information for disbursing funds?
Census funds are used for everything in your life and in a daily sense. I mean, most people will be surprised to find out one of the top ones is roads. And, of course, that's something that we all use. So the roads we drive on in the morning, and then maybe you drop the kids off for school. The schools themselves are funded according to the children's count. Hospitals and healthcare clinics, and in this economy, programs like unemployment insurance and job training. There's kind of a social safety net programs as well, like food stamps, et cetera. The count is also used to assist emergency programs, emergency assistance programs like Hurricane Katrina, where they not only had a good count of who was where, but also it funds the programs themselves through the type of apportionment funding that we've got. We have 170 major federal programs, everything from Medicaid to the roads and bridge repair. We actually have about 1,000 other, total programs, and it all amounts to $400 billion a year or $1,400 per person. That adds up really fast. If you figure just 100 people, that's really $1.5 million, nearly $1.5 million.
I'm going to interrupt you there. Could you talk about the community tracking program?
Yes, we will have the ability to know what neighborhoods are responding quickly. And on the form, we'll have kind of a barcode so that when people turn in their form, we can immediately scan that and determine what neighborhoods are responding. And then we can allocate resources right away to the neighborhoods that aren't doing so well.
Can that be seen online?
Yes. People will be able to go to that 2010 census.gov website and type in their zip code and see how they and their neighbors are doing.
Danny Luna, thank you very much for joining us today from the census. And we very much appreciate informing us on what's happening.
Thank you.
You're listening to Speak Up, Speak Out as we continue our discussion of the 2010 census. We switch courses now to discuss the local impact of whether a census is accurate or not. With me in the studio now are Karen Parnell, Deputy Director of Skagit County Community Action Agency, Jeannie Youngquist, Skagit County Auditor, and Gabriel Clay, the Outreach Coordinator for Elections in the Auditor's Office. We've just heard about the importance of a complete count in every community in the USA for the census. Let's take a look at the local impact. Gabriel, Skagit County is close to being required to provide a Spanish election ballot. What's the threshold level that the county has to provide that, and how will the census determine if Skagit has reached that?
The director census determines that more than 5% of the citizens of voting age reside in a state area of a single language minority. So, for example, at least 5% of voting age, not necessarily registered voters, just voting age, are of whatever origin in our area is a Hispanic origin, would require us to meet those.
But and that's just of Spanish surname. It's not of Spanish speaking. It's Spanish surname. And that's that we don't have that in the census. You know, the language preference is not in the census, only the race.
I was wondering about that. Having looked at the census form, how one determines language and determine that 5%.
Yeah.
So DOJ, it's Spanish surname.
Yeah. DOJ determines that.
Yeah. The according to the DOJ site, when we're looking, Department of Justice. They're determined from the most recent census, which would be this current census, and the determinations are made by the director of the census.
About how long does it take for that determination to be made?
That I'm not sure. I've heard approximately a year to 2 years, I think, roughly. Do you know?
In 2000, it took a couple years to determine that, and we were looking at 2013 as the implement time. However, you know, with technology as it is today, things can be sped up a lot. So we're alert to the fact that we may need to go forward with this sooner than was required in 2000 census.
And our goal is to be maybe not ready, but almost to that point by the time they say, this is what you need to do. You know, we want to be very proactive on this, not once it's required, then we have to meet whatever criteria set. We want to try to reach most of that criteria and get everything going, outreach, possibly the dual language ballots and information prior to them coming back and saying, you need to do this.
Yeah. Everything has to be bilingual. Everything that has to do with elections.
So it wouldn't be two separate ballots. It would be a bilingual ballot.
It's our choice, I believe, but we prefer, and what we've looked at is a single ballot because it's too difficult to know who would receive a Spanish ballot and who would receive an English ballot. The most fair way to do it is to have one single ballot with the English and Spanish version on the entire ballot.
So people can use their preference and may read one or the other.
Yeah.
One thing that was kind of interesting is looking at Yakima because they are one of three counties that are now in a bilingual election requirement. And, of course, there's a Spanish. And they have some percentages of that show who voted on a Spanish ballot and who voted on an English ballot. And a comparison from 1 year to the next, which were both since the census, but they've done more outreach from 2004 to 2008. So the percentage has increased about 10%, which is up in the neighborhood of 60-some percent of the Hispanic registered voters or surname registered voters.
Are using a Spanish ballot?
Are using a Spanish ballot. That's a surprising number. I thought it was a surprising number, but
that is quite a high number.
A very high number. I think in this area that it would really increase not only our registered voters, but also
Participation.
That's exciting. Want another little statistic?
Sure.
Okay. In Texas, this was in the Washington Post, and I kind of pulled that up because it had information about Yakima in it. But in Texas, in a county in Texas or a congressional district, they introduced Vietnamese, and they increased their participation. Doubled the participation by the Vietnamese when they added the Vietnamese ballot, but they also elected a Vietnamese congressional member, which was, you know, that's a surprising result
for people to come out
for the change in elections to bilingual. Yeah, kind of confirms our results.
There's also a possibility that Washington State will be receiving another Congress representative, bringing the total number from 9 to 10. How does this work, or how would it affect Skagit? Gabriel, do you want that?
Sure. It's possible that it will affect us. Skagit County is entirely inside Congressional District 2, and it stretches from the U.S.-Canadian border all the way down south of Everett. So in that sense, they would have to actually somehow move those lines into Skagit County for the congressional district to affect us. It is very likely that the commissioner and legislative districts will adjust some due to population, because that's how they adjust those. And at that point, we kind of react and have to adjust precinct lines, because there is law stating that those districts cannot cut a precinct in half.
Do precincts need to be about equal in number of people?
No.
Let's shift to Karen. Karen Parnell of Skagit County Community Action Agency, your turn now.
Thank you.
Give us some personal impact here. What happens as a result of the census here in programs and people that are being served in Skagit County?
You know, any federal dollars that touch anything in our agency or the local schools, local hospitals, the road construction crews, anything federal that touches our county will impact us. And my greatest fear is that not every person will be counted. I look at people that walk through our doors. We have pregnant women. We have families with new babies. We have people that are documented, people that are not. And every person needs to get on there. I am afraid that we will not be able to preserve the level of services that we have if there is an undercount. And so it's important for, you know, those families that kind of forget, oh, gee, you know, Susie over here and her husband are unemployed, and so they're living with us right now. Well, gee, they're part of our family. And so every single person needs to count there. In our agency, we have, you know, just an array of things around housing that serves homeless families as well as families that are kind of in some really tough ways. We have food programs, the WIC program. We have basic food outreach. These are all things that touch federal dollars that are passed down to us. We do a lot around volunteerism and services with seniors, and this is another area that could really impact the service level that goes to seniors, that comes to young families. It's really interesting to look at this aspect. If a family forgets to record their baby, it's going to be 10 years. That baby will be like an invisible person. And there will be services that will be missed out on. I understand it's like $1,400 per year per individual. When you add that up, it is like $140,000 over 10 years of time, which is pretty significant. So
it is for our programs that really meet the needs here in the county.
So kind of those are the really big things to get everybody counted. The other thing that is going on in our agency, we are one of two, I believe, in the county that we have a person with the Census Bureau staffed in our agency Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I think, from 9 to 12, and then Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, 1 to 4. And she can answer questions that people have. People that have a P.O. box will not receive a census form. They can pick up a census form in our office or at the Heart Print Food Pantry. They're the other question, the little census question center. People might have questions like, oh, gee, someone in my family is in jail right now. Do I need to count them? So, you know, just questions about that. Questions about race and ethnicity. I've heard that this is another one of those questions. There are only 10 questions on the survey, and they say it takes about 10 minutes to fill it out. But just be complete. Fill it out for every single person in the family, and let's count everybody.
Is there an outreach program specifically for, say, homeless?
I understand there are plans for count. You're referring to how the homeless people will be counted.
Mm-hmm.
There, after all of these forms are filled out by people and sent in, they go back through and check and see, gee, have we done this? Have we done that? Have we heard from them? Heard from this other person? And then they call them enumerators that go out into the community and are doing these big outreach efforts to capture homeless counts.
Would that also be used, the enumerators be used, for addresses that people may not get their mail at that address? They have a post office box.
Yes, I understand that they are going to find people. We want to get them counted now, so there's a danger of them not being counted and getting missed. You know, we want to preserve our funding, and where numbers go up, we really want to have those dollars that come in and support us, whether it's through community service block grant dollars, and this will be, here again, an allocation out of that area that really impacts community action agencies. We have our mental health ombuds, long-term care ombuds, just so literacy program.
Pretty basic needs really are being met by some of the federal funds coming in.
Very, very basic needs, and we're there for those people that are having tough times, and we want to continue being there at the level that we need to be. By the way, the question and answer survey center that we have in our agency, it runs through April 19th. So people can come in. We have a big sign plastered out on the front of the building. So hopefully that might capture some attention as people drive by. And
if people want to get in touch with Community Action and find out specific address and that sort of thing, can you give us their phone number?
Our agency number is 416-7585. Area code 360-416-7585.
Do you want to put elections on there, too, as a number to call for with questions?
Sure.
The elections, Skagit County elections number is 360-336-9305. Again, that number is 360-336-9305.
Gabriel Clay, Jeannie Youngquist, thanks very much for joining us from the Auditor's Office. And Karen Parnell, Skagit County Community Action Agency, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
That's it for Speak Up, Speak Out today. Please join us next week when Jody talks with Willie Galloway about gardening.
Join us each week for Speak Up, Speak Out. Archives are at speakupspeakoutradio.org. Theme music courtesy of Kurt Crandall. Until next time, seek peace, work for justice, celebrate diversity, and support your neighbors.
This program was produced in the studios of KSVR-FM by the Speak Up, Speak Out Collective. Distribution was made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.